Good evening, I'm Leland Vitter. There are stunning new numbers showing just how many illegal immigrants the Biden administration released into the United States last year. Released. We're going to tell you why this coming year might be even worse. Plus, live pictures tonight in Windsor, Ontario, where tens of millions of dollars worth of car parts and other key items sit in the supply chain stuck. Truckers are protesting vaccine mandates. They've brought commerce between the United States and Canada to a grinding halt. That's a road they're standing in the middle of, a bridge to the United States. One mayor wants police to physically remove the truckers and their friends. His justification for breaking up a peaceful protest when he joins us next. But first, the Department of Homeland Security now says truckers could pose a major threat to America. For 2 years of the pandemic, big rig drivers kept us fed, clothed, and awash in Amazon Prime deliveries. But now they are public enemy number one, as the Department of Homeland Security writes about a potential American convoy of truckers starting at this weekend's Super Bowl and heading to Washington, D.C. for President Biden's State of the Union to protest vaccine mandates. The DHS memo obtained by the Wall Street Journal reads, "While there are currently no indications of planned violence or civil unrest, if hundreds of trucks converge in a major metropolitan city, the convoy could potentially disrupt transportation, federal government and law enforcement operations, and emergency services through gridlock and potential counter-protests." Finally, now, it is nice to know that DHS and the FBI are focused on the real threats. Remember when the DOJ and Department of Education got together for a warning about parents who were protesting masks at school boards? Education Secretary Miguel Cardona allegedly solicited a letter comparing parents to domestic terrorists. Now, we can move on to truckers. The American convoy, though, isn't even a thing yet. It's quite literally a few people on internet message boards and on their phones, tweeting and Instagramming and telegraphing on encrypted messaging apps. The Biden administration's reaction says a lot. The trucker protest in Canada continues to threaten Liberal Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Video of a 78-year-old arrested for honking his horn in solidarity with the truckers. You can see the video of the arrest right there. Well, the truckers became emblematic of Justin Trudeau's heavy-handed approach. This video has gone viral. When arresting people for honking their horns didn't work, police in the Canadian capital started confiscating firewood. What does firewood have to do with police? Well, no, nobody was throwing firewood or trying to burn down government buildings with it. But the truckers needed it to keep warm in the sub-zero weather. But their continued protest and presence is a little embarrassing for Trudeau, hence police confiscating firewood. Back in America, President Biden is watching the Canadian trucker protest as he sits with record low approval numbers, below 40% in the Real Clear Politics average. And there's a CNN poll showing 56% of Americans, 56% say they don't approve of a single thing he has done. Mr. Biden, of course, ran on a campaign of helping the middle class, Joe from Scranton. Yet the middle class says it's not working. That came from the same CNN poll that shows 58% disapprove of how he is trying to help the middle class. And what's more middle class than a trucker's protest? Mr. Biden is a proud union supporter. There's nothing more union than the Teamsters, Teamsters truck drivers. And yet he's been silent, and his administration, as we're hearing, is issuing warnings. With that, we bring in Batya Unger-Sargon, deputy opinion editor of Newsweek. On the face of it, Batya, a liberal, pro-union president, pro-worker president, middle-class, blue-collar workers protesting the government, you'd think they would go hand in hand.
So first of all, Leland, I have to commend you for even covering this, because there's been a media blackout in Canada itself about the truckers' convoy, because the media is so in the grip of the kinds of liberal elites that you are correctly pointing out should really be on the side of this convoy. And instead, there have been these massive efforts across liberal media to smear them as racists, as fascists, as anything they can to avoid from the class dynamics that you just pointed out. This is the biggest working class protest, the biggest nonviolent labor action that I can recall seeing in my lifetime, and the left is on the other side of it.
Why?
I think it has a lot to do with how we see the economy. For elites, the economy is about trade. It's about consumer products. It's about the things that they get delivered to them by truckers. For working class people and lower middle class people, the economy is about jobs. It's about the right to work on their own terms, which is something that used to matter to the left and now no longer does, because the left is increasingly made up of overeducated liberals who are part of the knowledge economy, who are part of the elites now. And so they are very, very distant and separate from the working class and the middle class.
The obvious answer would be then that there is an political opportunity for Republicans. You think about President Biden's approval numbers. When it comes to the economy, they're even lower than they are on overall approval. I'm wondering why the change, if you will, by somebody who, for his entire career, Joe Biden, ran and talked about being the man from Scranton.
I mean, I think it has to do with the change in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party used to be the party of people from Scranton, working class, middle class people. Today, it's the party of overeducated liberal elites who are all in the pajama class. They're all in the COVID zero class. You know, they still want these restrictions when most of America, working class America, middle class America, is over it. You know, these people are not anti-vaccine. 90% of truckers are vaccinated. They're anti-mandate, which means they want to work and they want to work on their own terms, which is something that I can't stress this enough, that used to be the entire raison d'etre of the left. And because of the changing demographics within the Democratic Party, that no longer is the case.
You and I have talked about different facets of this, but it's all seeming to come together, right? That if you don't like vaccine mandates, you are a tin hat wearing conspiracy theorist. If you want safe streets, you're a racist. If you want low gas prices, you're anti-environment. And I'm wondering where the power in the politics of that branding of middle-class Americans comes from.
Well, you know, we started seeing that with Trump, right? He got 67% of whites without a college degree who immediately after the election were all branded as racists, right? I mean, that class divide, liberals do a lot to try to distract from it. And I think it's because liberals do still see themselves as on the side of the little guy, but they are increasingly affluent and increasingly benefiting from the economic inequality in America and the class divide in America. And so there's a lot of work put into messaging that helps distract them from that and distract others from that. But I think there's a mask-off moment happening right now, and I think Americans are starting to see through this.
What do you make of the difference in the media coverage of BLM and the riots of 2020 and the, as far as we've been able to tell, entirely peaceful trucker protests?
You know, it's really heartbreaking, because that kind of a disparity is so glaring. And so there has to be a lot of gaslighting put in order to distract from it. So the BLM protests, the Black Lives Matter protests, the vast majority of them were nonviolent, they were peaceful, and they were extremely important. However, there was undeniably about $2 billion of property damage and rioting and looting. And a lot of the businesses that were destroyed were the businesses of small business owners, underinsured or uninsured business owners, who were also people of color, who would be begging with the protesters not to destroy their life's work, you know, saying we support the message, we support Black Lives Matter.
You make excellent points in terms of the vast majority was peaceful, and then there was a very violent subset of it. You talked about $2 billion in damage. If you listen to the pro-trade group, right, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars a day in economic damage with these shutdowns of essentially one of the biggest trade routes in North America between Windsor, Ontario, and North America. You've got Ford plants shuttered. General Motors plant shuttered, Toyota expecting disruptions. I'm wondering, at some level, is there a different, do we have to be able to separate, yes, people should be able to protest, yes, the government should hear their grievances, and if they don't, there's a problem, but commerce must be able to go on.
Look, this is their leverage. I mean, they have all the leverage because we all require truckers. All of our liberal pieties about staying home and slowing the spread relied on their labor, them braving the plague in order to keep us safe at home, high on our own virtue, okay? They have this leverage and they are using it. That is what a nonviolent movement looks like, is you use every piece of nonviolent leverage you have. Now, I will say, of course, there are working class Americans who are working at Ford, working at GM,
right,
who had shifts canceled this week, right? But at the same time, those shifts will definitely be made up. That's what their bosses have been saying. And look, you don't hear liberals saying to people who want to work, you know, when there's a union strike, you don't hear them saying, look, you know, like, you know, which side are they on, right? They're on the side of the collective
action. It's a great
and
point.
That's what we're seeing here.
It's a great point. You didn't hear Joe Biden talking about how great the scabs were crossing the John Deere picket lines,
exactly,
or the Kellogg picket lines in Michigan.
Yeah.
Over the past couple of months. Hey, Batya, always good to talk. Thank you.
Thank you,
yeah,
Leland.
More on this on Batya's Twitter account, which is worth following. Good to see you. Back now to the showdown at the bridge, live pictures again. It could come to a head tonight. And as we said, big money's at play. Shutting down plants are costing tens of millions of dollars each day, and employees in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio are hurting just as badly as the companies. $300 million worth of goods cross over the Ambassador Bridge every day. $100 million of that is auto parts. And since the automakers aren't getting their parts, they've shut down some plants, impacting 150,000 workers on both sides of the border. The president of the Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association says law enforcement needs to act.
There is no chance of production tomorrow. And at the worst, at the best case scenario, we might be back in production early next week, assuming the blockade gets cleared today or tomorrow.
The mayor of Windsor, Ontario, wants to send in the police to clear the truckers and their sympathizers out. He's going to join us in a few minutes with his plan. The plant shutdowns, of course, will only make today's inflation numbers worse. Used cars, speaking of cars, are up 40% year over year. New cars are up double digits, mostly because of a computer chip shortage at the start of the pandemic. Inflation surged 7.5% over the past year, something that has not happened in my lifetime. Gas is up 40%, which drives the cost of everything else higher. Food is up more than 7%. We'll break that down in a minute. Electricity, 11%. Then you've got to pay rent, which is up 14% over last year. President Biden today says he feels America's pain.
We're in a situation now where, you know, you should have peace of mind. I know food prices are up and we're working to bring them down. As I said, I grew up in a family where the price at the pump went up, you felt it. And I understand. But these things are necessities.
Speaking of necessities, Mr. Biden's going to have to work hard to bring down food prices. Steak, pork, eggs, and chicken are up double digits across the board. Justin Tupper, Vice President of the U.S. Cattle Association, joining us now. Good to see you, sir. We appreciate it. All right, steak up double digits. Does that mean you guys are rolling in the dough?
I wish that was the case, Leland, but we're sure not seeing it down here at the producer level. So, no, inflation is definitely biting into us in a deep, deep way. Our prices are up all across the board, and we're not seeing a return that's coming back to our producer level.
When you say your prices are up, that means fuel, feed, transport for your cattle, labor, and you're not getting anything else for it. So who's getting the 17%?
Well, there's a big four packing companies in our industry that have recorded record profits. Tyson's earnings for 2021 up over 48%. That's just one of the big four companies. And a lot of that's due to them being able to gouge the consumers as the prices rise at their counter and give us less for our product when we're trying to sell to them.
Everything's costing more. You're not getting any more money. At some point, do you just give up?
I don't think we're built that way. I think we're a resilient bunch. Cattle producers have been at it for a long time, but definitely feeling the pinch. And then we have a unprecedented drought in large portions of the Midwest. So definitely feeling the pinch of the inflation. And then, of course, the big four packers giving us the squeeze to boot.
Yeah, Paul Harvey had that great, great thought about God made a farmer, so ranchers are included in that. at some point, you can't give up, but you need help. Here is Senator Chris Coons, one of President Biden's closest allies, on what President Biden should do. Take a listen.
My advice to the president will be keep on the direction you're headed. Bring down the prices that impact the everyday life of working families through passing things like prescription drug price reform and continuing to get us out of this pandemic.
Prescription drug price reform sounds sort of like a needle in a haystack compared to the problems that you guys are facing.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, fuel prices, especially, as you alluded to earlier in your show, affects everything. We move cattle around the country. We move feed to the cattle. And fuel prices is a big part of that. So, and we're seeing those increase across the board, all the way through the states. And then, of course, we're paying more for the feed that we feed those cattle. So as we see the inflation rise, we need to find a way to get a bigger piece of the pie, get a referee in the game with these big four packers and see if we can't get a little bit more of that back down to the grassroots level.
Give me a sense, you've been at this for a long time, of where prices were when you started, of the inputs you deal with and what you're dealing with now.
You know, for example, you know, as we could cost of gains to feed these critters, we were figuring to put a pound of gain on the cattle. We were looking at somewhere around 60 cents probably 2 years ago. And today we're looking at somewhere around $1.50 a pound to put that on.
Wow.
And so that's almost an unbelievable amount. And we've seen prices increase slightly in fat cattle, but it's kind of a seasonal thing more than it is we're working to get better prices all the way through.
Justin, I don't think any of us realize what goes into making a steak when we sit down to eat it, but there's a lot of people who are grateful for the hard work and bad weather and what you do, so we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you having us.
Keep it up. Breaking news now from our station in Albany, New York. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is going after the New York Attorney General, and this could change a lot, conceivably perhaps a prelude to Andrew Cuomo running for office again. He plans to file an ethics complaint after Letita James investigated him for sexual harassment. Cuomo's attorney claims investigators ignored evidence of witness tampering, witness intimidation, and perjury. They go on to say the investigation was driven by James's desire to run for governor. Remember, she announced for governor and then unannounced. Cuomo has talked to a few people, perhaps, about running for office again. So the saga of the Cuomo brothers in New York City and what was a major earthquake in New York politics, in American politics, continues to rumble. More on that tomorrow. And up next, new numbers offering a stunning look inside the border crackdown, or lack thereof a crackdown. We're going to tell you about the immigration debate we should be having but are not. Plus, Joe Burrow wants all the smoke. We'll tell you about the star quarterback's stogie habit that has captivated Cincinnati and soon to be the country if he wins the Super Bowl. Studying new numbers today just show how bad the crisis at the southern border has gotten. Live pictures of Washington, D.C. right now. Obviously, Republicans are going to hope to use these numbers during the midterm elections. The Biden administration has been slow to put them out. For months, we've been telling you about the total number of migrant encounters. That's the number that the Customs and Border Protection puts out. But now we're seeing numbers that show exactly what happens after the pictures you see right now. In 2021, less than 5% of migrants encountered at the border were deported. That is a stunning drop compared to 27% in 2019 and 40% in 2020. We suspected this. We're reporting on it. The video of migrants being dropped off at bus stations and airports all across the southern border, we saw, Ali Bradley recorded it, but I don't think anybody thought the numbers were going to be just this bad. Ali Bradley with us now from her travels reporting on the border. Ali, from what the administration says to what you saw on the ground to the reality of the numbers, is there anything that is consistent?
Absolutely not, Leland. And you're saying, you know, we didn't maybe know that the numbers were this bad. If you're on the ground out here, you did. We've been trying to get the word out that these numbers are astronomical. And I'm hearing from border agents and ICE agents, my sources all telling me, not a lot of people are getting sent back. And now we're seeing these numbers that prove that. And, you know, we're just seeing different issues as far as who is really staying and who's not. Different sectors will tell me, oh, we're deporting Cubans and Venezuelans. Another sector will say, oh, we're just deporting Haitians. Another will say, we're not deporting Nicaraguans, Cubans, or Venezuelans. So it's kind of arbitrary. It doesn't seem very consistent at all.
One of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because you've spent so much time talking to migrants, both as they come up through Mexico and then once they're in the United States. How many of them that you talk to have heard from their friends who've made the journey before and are part of these numbers, thus told their friends, now is the time to come?
Well, let's start with American citizens telling those folks that now is the time to come, and it's easier now than it's ever been. I know that is happening. Several migrants have told me they have friends in the States basically laying out the pathway for them and what they need to do. Now, those 5,000 people I walked with starting back in October, Leland, out of the contacts I made and out of the connections I've made, there's about 20 of them. They're all here. They're all working. They are, of course, under the table because right now they can't legally work. They can't legally do anything. And so they end up getting here and they're kind of forced to have their hand out because they don't really have a lot of options once they get here and they're waiting for their so-called asylum claims. Because even if they're economic migrants, the majority of them are claiming asylum. That gives them the right to be here. That gives them the right
to be here. I just want to be clear here. So there's a number of people that you talked to that you were within the caravan who are now in the United States sort of illegally, but legally because they were released. What are they doing for work? Tell us about their lives.
Well, you know, one of them is a lawyer from Venezuela. When I met him, he speaks very good English. He was telling me that he left everything in Venezuela, left his opportunity as a lawyer there because clients couldn't pay him, right? So he's not making any money because people don't have any money to give. So he came here and said, I'm willing to do anything. Right now, he's working at a little tiny restaurant in Maryland, you know, behind the scenes, kind of under the table. Now, another family is saying the husband had to go get work. She can't work because the kid is in school. They've already got their toddler in school. They've only been here for about a month. So we are seeing them come in, of course, and kind of create their lives already.
Yeah, I have a soft spot, and it's difficult covering this story, and I admire the deftness that you do it with because at the micro level, the people who leave Venezuela, which has an oppressive communist dictator, leave everything behind and risk it all to come to America to have their American dream, you can't help but feel for them. On the macro level, we have no idea who's coming through the border, and there's these competing issues. I'm wondering if you, when you talk to your lawyer friend who's now working at a restaurant, is he calling his friends back in Venezuela and sort of has paved the pathway for them?
You know, he hasn't told me that. None of these migrants have told me specifically, Leland, that they've picked up the phone, made the call, and told these people how to get here. But that's how they got here. So it's you know, not beyond us to say that that is happening. But when I met them in Yuma, when I've met them at border crossings, at breach points in from Texas to Arizona, they tell me they're meeting up with family. And a lot of them, again, know exactly what pathway to take and exactly what to do. And we've been reporting this. And then we see those people, you know, what I'm being told here by an immigration attorney that I just spoke with, when these folks, when these migrants show up for an asylum claim, they show up and the judge just makes sure that they're a physical body, that they're there, right? Now, we don't really know if their name is really their name at this point. We don't really know much about them because they probably dumped their documents. We've covered that before. Some of them saying those documents will hurt them more than they can help them. So, you know, when you get these people that are going to a judge, they just have to show up. We already know less than 50% are doing that, right around the 50% mark. But then they might not see a judge again to actually determine that asylum claim for like 6 years, this immigration attorney is telling me. And yeah, it is having an impact on those American citizens that maybe married someone that's in another country. They're waiting to bring them here, or they're maybe in a backlog. They've got a green card and they're waiting for their process. This all has a bigger ripple effect.
How much, when you talk to border agents, how much do they say could be changed by changes in the Biden administration's policies versus just the economic reality of where the world's at?
Well, Leland, for example, when I had first started this trip, I was on the, I'm on the road now. This is, I think, day 31. When I was starting in Texas, there was a little 7-year-old Venezuelan girl that drowned trying to cross into Del Rio. Border agents were telling me, outside of politics, outside of everything, they're frustrated because they're like, that's our job. Our job is to help these people, is to make sure people aren't dying, to make sure that we're able to do our job, manning the border, watching for illegal activity, watching for criminal activity, and that includes drug trafficking. So, you know, they believe that going back to some of those policies in their actual legitimate form from the prior administration, not these more watered down policies we're seeing, they do believe that something will change. One agent said, you know, the last administration wasn't perfect, but at least things felt like they were more under control.
Well, when you look at these numbers, 1.73 million people encountered and less than 60,000 deported, as we said, less than 5%, it's really stunning. Ali, incredible reporting throughout. Really appreciate you being here. Thank you. Ali said something so important here about so many of these people are moving into the black and gray economy in the United States. There's 11 million open jobs in the United States. Is there a way to bridge this gap? Is it legal immigration? The data on that and how it could save the US economy and solve the supply chain crisis when we come back. All right, before the break, we were talking about the stunning numbers of illegal immigrants, not only who came across the border, last year, 1.7 million. But how many were not deported, i.e. how many people were released? The 1.7 million people who came across the border, only 550,000 were released. That means about 1.6 and change million were released into the United States. And as Ali Bradley told us, so many illegal immigrants released into the country go into the gray or black economy, all the more now because only about 5% are deported, whereas before up to 20 or 40% of illegal immigrants were sent home. But even though you've got all these people here illegally, they're not nearly enough people to fill the open jobs in America. Right now, the economy needs 10.9 million workers and is creating jobs faster than Americans are having babies, which could prove a major problem in the years to come. Liberty Vitter, professor of data science at Washington University in St. Louis and the features editor of the Harvard Data Science Review, also my favorite sister, although I don't have a choice because I only have one, joins us now. All right, Liberty, U.S. birth rates, baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z, you have something called the replacement rate. So does that mean we effectively run out of people?
Basically, in the past 60 years, the U.S. birth rate has decreased by more than 50%, and it's continuing to decrease. And this isn't by design, this is just happening, which means, one, we don't have enough workers to fill the jobs that we need, and we have a huge bill for basic government programs. We're not going to have enough taxpayers to pay that. I mean, if you just take the basic numbers, in 1945, there were 40 workers per Social Security beneficiary. Today, there's 2.6 workers per beneficiary. In the next 10 years, we're going to be lucky to have one worker per beneficiary. And those numbers just don't work out.
Yeah, that's kind of scary. And this is sort of, I guess, more fodder for mom and dad to tell us to have grandkids, but I digress. Migrants who obtained legal resident status per year by decade, we're at the highest it's ever been, 1,063,000. If you found some way to give those people here illegally right now, undocumented, roughly 10 or so million people in America, do they transition into these jobs without taking jobs from Americans who are already here and citizens?
Absolutely. We have 10.9 million jobs open, legal jobs open. We only have 6.5 million people who are unemployed. There are more than enough jobs. Everyone has the ability to be working right now. So we could easily open up these jobs to people who are illegal immigrants right now. And frankly, in order to support our economy in the future and stave off what is legitimately economic disaster in the future, is to bring in even more people. We need to increase immigration if we want to keep our numbers steady.
Right. The flip side of this, though, is that if you don't bring in these illegal immigrants, those 10.9 million jobs will have to pay more to Americans who are already here, why not protect the wages of people who are here rather than sort of open the floodgates for illegal immigrants who are going to be encouraged to come because that now they know there's jobs?
The numbers don't even come close to working out. We have 165 million people employed in the United States, and those people are going to need Medicare. They are going to need Social Security in the future. And I certainly think a lot of them would rather retire than get a teensy, teensy, teensy tiny bump in the wages. So, I mean, really the question that you're asking is, are we willing to sacrifice the economic stability of our entire country's future for the jobs of a couple million people?
So
there's
a lot of people choosing not to work. How many people do we need to let in per year and allow them to work to make the math work?
At the moment, if the birth rate stays the same, over 2 million.
Wow, double what we are right now. Liberty, thank you very much. Good to see you as always. Back now to our top story. A Canadian mayor tells truckers to get out of the way or they may be forced out. He joins us with his reasoning for arresting those peacefully protesting when we come back. Back now to the standoff crippling American commerce in Michigan and the Midwest. Truckers versus the Canadian government. Live pictures now of Windsor, Ontario. This is the road to the bridge to America over which about $400 million worth of commerce passes each day. It's been shut down in the past 72 hours. Blockades by the Freedom Convoy protesting vaccine mandates took a new turn. They shut down the Ambassador Bridge between the United States and Canada. That's disrupting manufacturing across the Midwest. At least two car plants have shut down for lack of parts from Canadian suppliers. Others are cutting shifts. The bridge is responsible for $500 million worth of commerce every day. So clearly the truckers have everyone's attention. Windsor's the latest stop by the Freedom Convoy. They block streets in Canada's capital, a border crossing in Montana, a highway near Ontario, and now the bridge connecting Windsor to Detroit. Windsor's mayor says he has had enough and is taking the truckers to court. Mayor Drew Dilkins joins us now. All right, Mayor, where do we stand?
The blockade is still in place. It's illegal. We're going to court tomorrow at noon to seek an injunction. And following that exercise, if we're successful, police will have all the authority they need and more to be able to move in if they can't gain voluntary compliance.
How do you justify getting an injunction against what is, at least by the video that we have, a peaceful protest?
Yeah, listen, there is no doubt the hallmark of our joint democracies is the ability to express yourself, the ability to demonstrate and protest. That is okay. What is not okay is choking off the busiest border crossing between our two nations, the lifeline for an essential part of our economies here. And as you said, $400 million a day crosses at that particular bridge crossing alone.
Yeah, the flip side is that if they were shutting down a side street there in Windsor, where some of the after-hours bars were, nobody'd care, the media wouldn't be covering it, we wouldn't be having the discussion about their grievances. How can you ask them to give up the only power they have?
Well, because they're undertaking an illegal action. They don't have the power just to shut down an entire roadway at their own will that is going to impact tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Americans and Canadians, people who need to put bread on their table too.
Yeah, well, there's no question. There's a lot of American workers who are not going to be getting as big of a paycheck because of this. Here's one of the protesters talking about what might happen if you get that injunction. Take a listen.
You can bring out the riot police, like they said they would, and it would turn out very ugly.
We have to be ready for violence.
Listen, the last thing I want to see is anyone get hurt. And our police force has worked very, very diligently to try and negotiate with the folks that are on the ground here to try and find a sensible resolution. A sensible resolution could be allowing a lane of traffic to move in each direction to the international border crossing, and we'll give them a lane on each side to continue their protest. But that's not acceptable, and the fact is this is a leaderless group. No one is in charge. And although we're talking about vaccine mandates and mask mandates being the premise for this organization and this protest, it has gravitated to be something much, much different. I would equate what I see on the ground here to be more analogous to a protest group that you see at a G7 or G20 meeting. There are lots of different interests here, and it's not just related to COVID restrictions or protocols.
I understand that, and I keep hearing now, it's been infiltrated by right-wing groups and right-wing extremist groups. But forgive me, but it feels pretty disingenuous, especially when you have Prime Minister Trudeau sitting there saying, oh, these are a bunch of Nazi racists, and then our reporters on the ground can't find any evidence of that.
Yeah, well, listen, they did experience that. There's lots of video and evidence what happened in Ottawa. So we haven't seen that type of racism or hate down here on the streets in Windsor, which I'm happy that that didn't happen down here. But at the end of the day, we still have a municipal roadway that is completely blocked.
Do you have any sympathy? So many of the guys that we talk to in this convoy say, I'm vaccinated. I just don't like being told what to do. Do you have any sympathy for these folks? If you're, you know, this is a liberal government. If you can't listen to the grievances of workers, who do you listen to?
God, of course I have sympathy. Like, we've all gone through this pandemic. None of us have ever lived through a pandemic, and we've all gone through this rather horrible experience for the last 2 years. And there are things that we've had to compromise on, things we've been asked to do, sacrifices that every single person, every family has had to make. And it's been tough. It's been tough on a lot of people. And I would submit that the folks that are out here now, it's probably been the most tough on. So much so that they're willing to leave their jobs, they're willing to park on a roadway, and according to some who are on the ground, they're willing to die for this cause. And so I get that it's been tough, and I do have some sympathy, but at the end of the day, I have to balance the right, one's right to protest and to demonstrate with the rights of the economy and the businesses here and the families that need to work, especially in, you know, the city of Windsor. We're the auto capital of Canada. An auto sector that has already been devastated by a global chip shortage and other supply chain issues with respect to COVID. We can't layer on more pain and affect more families at the same time. Something has to happen, and this protest at this location cannot be allowed to go on forever.
At some point, and I've learned this covering a lot of riots in my life, and sometimes it's worked and sometimes it hasn't, because God knows I've gotten on the wrong side of these orders from police and from mayors. But if you really confront this and you end up in the fight by the prime minister against the protesters in Ottawa, which are different because they're not blocking a bridge, they're surrounding parliament, and your actions, do you worry that you're making it worse and only giving sort of more fuel to the fire of these protesters and to their sympathizers?
I don't worry about that. I mean, at the end of the day, I would be more concerned with seeing 100 or 200 people be flushed out of the streets here to have 400 show up the next day. That's a legitimate concern and one that, you know, folks are working on contingency plans to deal with.
Wow. So you guys view that as a real possibility?
It is a possibility. And we see what's happening not just at the border crossing here, but the border crossing an hour away up in Sarnia and Port Huron and other locations in Coutts, Alberta. And so I get that this is going to get a lot of attention. When you shut down a major pipeline, an economic pipeline to our two countries, you're going to get attention, a lot more so than you would get by parking your rigs on a municipal street in the nation's capital where they're used to demonstrations on a regular basis. And so they've got the attention. At the end of the day, I can't give them what they want. The federal government, the provincial government are all pointing their fingers at me saying, this is a municipal road. You have a policing responsibility to police municipal roads.
It sounds like we've gotten to the heart of the matter. It sounds like the federal government has put you in an impossible position. They won't be the ones to get the blame for it. You will. Hey, Mayor, unfortunately, we're out of town. I really admire and appreciate you coming on and talking about this. Please come back as this develops. We'll look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thanks, Leland.
Yeah. Not a lot of mayors who will come on and have the conversation that the mayor just did. We're admiring. Thank you. Cincinnati Bengals quarterback Joe Burrow smoking one of his trademark victory cigars. Now the entire town of Cincinnati is on the cigar bandwagon ahead of the Bengals' Super Bowl appearance this weekend. It's now impossible to find Burrow's chosen puff. The La Flor Dominica cigar is sold out. The Wharf Cigar Store in Cincy has sold hundreds just this week. Joining us now, manager of the Wharf, Lonnie Race. All right, you've got the T-shirt on, the cigars behind you. Are they really that good?
Oh, they're awesome cigars.
Wow. All right. So I think about cigars. I think about sort of this elite group, right? Winston Churchill, John Kennedy, Babe Ruth, Mark Vittert, George Patton, Mark Twain, all tied together by their love of a stogie. Does Joe Burrow belong on that list?
I think he does. He's smoking a cigar for when he wins, and it's really the outbringing has come out a long way in the last week.
All right, so tell me what it's been like at the store with this one cigar.
Well, we within 2 days, we sold over 100 cigars, and we've been searching 7 states, and also the VP of La Florida Dominicana tried to help us out and search cigars down in the Dominican, and they have none at all right now.
So this started by Burrow when he was at LSU, smoking cigars to celebrate a victory. Then he came to Cincinnati. Did he come buy this one cigar from you guys on a lark, or is there some reason he loves this one cigar?
No, he hasn't been up here yet. What he said was that he has only smoked cigars after victories, so he hasn't really smoked a lot of cigars.
You have any idea why he chose this one cigar?
No, just the uniqueness of the cigar. It is shaped a little bit different than most cigars.
Can we see, grab one out of the box for us?
Yes.
So as you can see, it's more of a torpedo shape. So if you are going to smoke this cigar, it would be, you smoke, cut about 3/4 of an inch off to get a full draw. It's going to be a nice little bit of sweetness to it with some natural, earthy, woodsy flavors.
Gotcha. How expensive are they?
Right now, they're only $18.25 a piece.
Only $18.25, but you say right now, you think they're going to go up in price?
They could. When something like this happens, the more scarce the cigar is, like anything, it's going to raise the price.
And so we have no idea how he picked this. He was photographed, though, smoking this after a couple of the games. So people who are coming in and buying the cigar, do they say they're going to only smoke it if the Bengals win?
That's what we're hoping doesn't happen, because we've got about over 30 boxes on order, and they're going to come in after the Super Bowl, unfortunately.
Well, you are betting a lot on the Bengals winning, so
yes.
Good luck. There's a lot of sports betting going on. We're going to talk about that more tomorrow. Hey, great conversation, Lonnie. Thanks, and we'll be thinking about you Super Bowl Sunday.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Good to see you. All right. There you go. I'm not going to smoke a cigar, but there you go. SoFi Stadium, Inglewood, California. We'll see you tomorrow.